Due to the graphic nature of this spy's crimes, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes discussions of murder, abuse, and assault that some people may find offensive. We advise extreme caution for children under the age of 13. It was November 9th, 1939. World War II had just begun. On the still peaceful Western Front, in the small Dutch town of Venlo, a nervous Walter Schillenberg was waiting at a cafe for his two British contacts to arrive, a mere 16 feet from the German border. His well-thought-out operation was about to reach its culmination. Schillenberg had everything riding on this. If he pulled it off, it would be a huge victory for him and for Nazi Germany. Hitler had personally demanded that Schillenberg capture these British agents. The stakes had never been higher. Schillenberg spotted the Buick in the distance as it approached the cafe. The car swiftly turned off to the side of the cafe and came to a stop. Recognizing his contact at the wheel, Schillenberg approached the car, waving from about 10 yards away. This was the signal. Hidden Nazis burst across the border. Gunshots rang out in every direction. And in the middle of all the chaos stood Walter Schillenberg, ready to risk it all for his country, ready to change the course of the war and world history with one well-timed spy mission. This is Espionage, the Parcast original exploring the missions of the world's most incredible spies and what brought their covert operations into the public eye. And throughout this show, we'll explore real-world spy tactics required to impersonate, exploit, and infiltrate the most confidential places in the world. I'm Carter Roy. You can find all episodes of Espionage and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Espionage for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Espionage in the search bar. At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. And if you enjoyed today's episode, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help. This is our first episode on infamous Nazi super spy, Walter Schillenberg. Shrewd and calculating, Walter Schillenberg wasted no time in climbing his way through the ranks to become the head of all foreign intelligence in Nazi Germany. His innate understanding of subterfuge and his close relationships with some of the most dangerous men in the world boosted his ascent to the top. This week, we'll track how Schillenberg rose to power. It all started with the Venlo incident, the event which facilitated Hitler's invasion of the Netherlands. Next week, in part two, we'll explore how Schillenberg's role in the Venlo incident led to his meteoric rise in the Nazi counterintelligence department. Walter Friedrich Schillenberg was born the youngest of 7 children on January 16, 1910, in the border town of Saarbrücken, Germany. Thanks to the German economic crisis after World War I, Schillenberg grew up surrounded by poverty. Perhaps hoping to escape economic hardship, he enrolled at the German University of Bonn to study law in 1929. But by his graduation in 1933, the political and economic strife was at an all-time high. There were 6 million unemployed people in Germany. They were desperate for someone to fix the situation. That's when an ambitious man fighting for the pride and unification of Germany came to power. His name was Adolf Hitler, and in 1933, he was sworn in as Chancellor of Germany. 23-year-old Schellenberg, like many Germans, was moved by Hitler's impassioned speeches promising a stronger, unified Germany. He was impressed by the regal black uniforms of the growing Nazi Party, and he was beguiled by the notion of innate, racially based German superiority. It was nice to feel special. But what he liked most of all were Hitler's promises of economic stability and wealth. Schellenberg didn't buy the Nazi ideology wholesale. As he later wrote, "I was certain, as were the majority of Germans, that Hitler was a political realist, and that having gained power, he would now drop the more extreme and unreasonable aspects of his program, such as the measures against Jews." But joining the party was, for Schellenberg, a practical move. As the Nazis came to power, he knew embracing their movement would help his career, and Schellenberg was an ambitious man. In 1933, at age 23, Schellenberg joined the elite Nazi unit called the Schutzstaffel, or the SS, otherwise known as the Führer's Special Guard. As Schellenberg explained, in the SS, one found the better type of people, and membership brought considerable prestige and social advantages. Just what he wanted. But Schellenberg found military duty dull and monotonous. He was a trained lawyer, after all, and used to working with his mind. So he was excited when he was able to secure a more interesting activity within the SS, facilitating talks and lectures on Germanic law for students and workers. It was in one of these lectures that he caught the eye of Reinhard Heydrich, often considered one of the darkest and most evil figures of the Nazi Party. Schellenberg described Reinhard Heydrich as a tall man with small, restless eyes as crafty as an animal's, a long, predatory nose. His hands were slender and rather too long. They made one think of the legs of the spider. At the time, Heydrich was the chief of Germany's main security office. He was a dark, looming figure, feared even within the Nazi Party, as Schellenberg's description makes clear. But fortunately for Schellenberg, Heydrich liked him. In 1935, Heydrich took 25-year-old Schellenberg under his wing and brought him into Sicherheitsdienst, or SD, the secret intelligence agency within the SS. As the chief of the main security office, Heydrich oversaw the SD. Schellenberg, who had a passion for foreign affairs and policy, was overjoyed. He was moving in the right direction, clearly towards success. Schellenberg thrived in the SD. He loved being involved in an organization that was not only exclusive, but vital to the success of Germany. The work was engaging too, in part thanks to the fact that it varied wildly. He traveled to France to learn the political views of a professor at the Sorbonne. Around the same time, he went to Italy for a security assignment and set up a network of spies. He was sent on counterintelligence missions across the world, from Dakar to Lisbon, Madrid to Warsaw. Schellenberg was never bored, and he was confident that with every mission, he was reminding the SD of his worth. But he also started to realize there seemed to be a larger plan behind these disparate missions. He stated, "I got the impression that my movements were being plotted as though by an unseen hand." Schellenberg suspected that unseen hand was Reinhard Heydrich, the spider-like man who brought him into the SD. He was right. Heydrich saw potential in Schellenberg and was grooming his young protege. But by the time Schillenberg turned 27 in 1937, it wasn't just Heydrich taking note of his consistently impressive work and intelligence. He also caught the eye of another high-ranking Nazi official, Heinrich Himmler. Heinrich Himmler was the head of the SS from 1929 to 1945, and more importantly, he was the bodyguard and close confidant of Adolf Hitler himself. Schillenberg was interested in Himmler too. He was as unusual as he was powerful, not the least thanks to his ardent belief in Catholic spiritualism and mysticism. Once, Schillenberg found Himmler and 12 of the most powerful SS leaders sitting in a circle. They were concentrating on mentally exerting the truth from an accused general. Well, it's unclear whether or not this worked, but Himmler remained in power despite his eccentricities. Schillenberg didn't mind Himmler's mysticism. He was equally unmoved by Himmler's central role in the creation of Nazi concentration camps, something most people would be upset by. While he didn't necessarily share Himmler's fervency, Schillenberg was well aware of the opportunities Himmler's good opinion would afford him, and he was willing to accept whatever he had to do to preserve it. On March 12, 1938, Schillenberg got the perfect opportunity to cement Himmler's trust. He was traveling with Himmler to Austria for the Anschluss, or the annexation of Austria into Nazi Germany. Schillenberg was tense. The weather was bad, not ideal for a plane ride, and the pressure to impress Himmler was draining. But he remained alert despite the nagging exhaustion. Schillenberg always paid attention to details. It was part of what made him so valuable to the SD. And on March 12, 1938, part of what made him so valuable to Himmler himself. As the plane ascended high into the air, Schillenberg noticed a safety catch was off on one of the aft doors, and Himmler himself happened to be standing in front of it, about to lean back. Schillenberg leapt toward Himmler just as the man's body weight started to push against the door. The pair toppled to the floor as cold air blasted over them. Schillenberg had saved Himmler's life. It wasn't a favor Himmler would forget, or a favor that would go unrepaid. At the young age of 28, Schillenberg had secured the confidence of both Reinhard Heydrich and Heinrich Himmler, two of the most powerful men in Nazi Germany. Their confidence only grew firmer as Schillenberg and Himmler returned to Germany. At Heydrich's directive, Schillenberg established and bugged a high-class Berlin brothel called the Salon Kitty with both agents and listening devices. Heydrich was pleased with his subtle, intelligent use of both human and technical resources. Ever diligent and perceptive, Schillenberg also wrote up weekly reports for Himmler on the state of Germany's military positions. Himmler was so impressed, he started asking for Schillenberg's opinions on the information, as well as the reports. Schillenberg didn't just maintain a good opinion of his mentors. Many of his Nazi colleagues liked him too. He was an intellectual, but still knew how to make whoever he was talking to feel relaxed. One superior described him as open, impeccable, and honest character, firm, tough, possesses energy, healthy common sense, thinks very sharply, demonstrates a clear vision, caution, and immediately recognizes the larger issues. He believed not in force, not in nonsense, but in subtlety. This perceptive, attractive intelligence, both intellectual and social, made Schillenberg an excellent employee, and specifically, an excellent spy. According to former CIA officer J.C. Carlson, clandestine work is about understanding, analyzing, and applying human behavior, which is more psychological than technical. Heydrich and Himmler were right to tap Schellenberg as their protege. All the skills needed for espionage were in his wheelhouse. But before those qualities would propel him to the heights of the SD, he had to prove himself in the field. Coming up, we'll follow Walter Schellenberg on his first major undercover mission. Now, back to the story. In the 1930s, Walter Schellenberg rose quickly through the ranks of the Nazi counterintelligence agency, the SD. He continually impressed his superiors with his intelligence, both intellectual and social, particularly his two mentors, Nazi leaders Reinhard Heydrich and Heinrich Himmler. But it wasn't until September 1939, when Schellenberg was 29, that he got his chance to prove that he could be the best spy in Germany. On September 1st, the Germans invaded Poland on their eastern border. With this, World War II officially began. The Western Front, however, remained quiet for the time being. This was in part because the Dutch were steadfastly maintaining their neutrality. But everyone knew it was only a matter of time before something ticked off a bomb amongst the country's quiet windmills. Various spy rings, both British and German, began to infiltrate the Netherlands in anticipation of a new battlefront. Schellenberg, ever alert, had ears on the ground, and it wasn't long before his informants caught him up on British intelligence's directive. They were looking to find unhappy anti-Nazi German exiles who would be willing to turn on Hitler. Two inexperienced MI6 agents, Major Richard Stevens and Captain Sigismund Payne Best, were in charge of the operation. As Schellenberg dug into the case, he found that German intelligence was already working to infiltrate the British operation. They had a camera set up opposite the barge that was Major Stevens' office, and they were wooing Stevens and Best with a double agent, Franz Fischer. Fischer, aka Agent F479, was posing as a German refugee in the Netherlands who was eager to talk to the British, but he was secretly working with the Nazis. The operation had been a success so far. Fischer made contact with the MI6 agents, Best and Stevens. He had told the MI6 agents he knew of a group of anti-Hitler German exiles who were ready to defect and help the Brits overthrow Hitler. Schellenberg, analyzing the operation from back in Germany, was impressed. Clearly, the operation was doing all right without his involvement. But he had a few tricks up his sleeve. Tricks he hadn't been able to try since he'd never worked as a double agent. It was time for that to change, he realized, if he wanted to challenge his abilities and take his career to the next level. He was going into the field. Though Schellenberg wasn't walking into a perfectly primed mission, Captain Best was already suspicious that Fischer was an agent provocateur, a particular kind of double agent. According to the CIA, these agents are sent by Service A to Service B to tell B that he works for A but wants to switch sides. Best saw right through Fischer. He even wrote a report complaining about this obvious Nazi stooge. But his report was ignored. The war had just begun, and Neville Chamberlain, the British Prime Minister, was desperate to reach a peaceful conclusion. So desperate, his Secret Service headquarters was engaging in some dangerous wishful thinking. Thanks to his informers in the Netherlands, Schellenberg understood the desperation of the Brits, and he was determined to use these unique circumstances to his advantage. Well, Schellenberg's first step to prepare for the mission was a careful study of the case. He read Fisher's reports daily. Then, he chose his undercover identity, basing it off a real transport department officer, Captain Hauptmann Schimmel. Well, there was always a risk of discovery when posing as someone else, but Schellenberg was not going to leave anything to chance. He wore a monocle, just like the real Schimmel, and he crafted a perfect story to endear him to the Brits. He knew a top German general in Hitler's inner circle who was ready and willing to overthrow the Führer. October 21st, 1939, was the day of Schellenberg's first meeting with the Brits as Captain Schimmel. It was a dark and rainy day as he drove to the Dutch border. Schellenberg could not suppress a feeling of uneasiness. He was excited, but it was a nervous excitement. His mentor, Reinhard Heydrich, was personally invested in this, and he knew proving field chops would give his career the final boost it needed to reach the heights of the Nazi hierarchy. Schellenberg couldn't mess it up. Captain Best picked Schellenberg up in a Buick and drove him to meet with his colleagues, Major Stevens and Lieutenant Copins. At the behest of his superiors, Best had put aside his suspicions about the Nazis' spy games. Plus, this Captain Schimmel fellow was new. Even if the other German had been an agent provocateur, Schimmel seemed genuine. Stevens, like Best, was naively hopeful about this meeting with Schimmel. Lieutenant Copins seemed on board as well. Schellenberg found Captain Best especially to be a pleasant man. The two bonded over the fact that they both wore monocles, though Schellenberg's was fake. But the talk soon turned serious. Schellenberg, or Schimmel, as these new colleagues knew him, told the group in serious, hushed tones that there was a major rebel movement deep within the Nazi ranks. They wanted to overthrow and bring down Hitler, and they were led by one of Hitler's top generals. The British agents bought it. Schellenberg felt his excitement rising as Best told him that the British government was more than inclined to work with them to remove Hitler. The ruse was working. They trusted him. While no commitments could be made yet, the MI6 agents wanted to continue talks and perhaps meet this high-ranking Nazi official who was so eager to bring down the Führer. Schellenberg was elated. He hinted this might be possible down the line. And then he arranged to meet the British agents once again in just over a week, on October 30th, 1939. The new partners parted ways in good spirits, and Schellenberg, eager to report his findings to his superiors, rushed back to Germany. From a rented room in Dusseldorf, Schellenberg called Berlin to report the developments. Heydrich was so pleased he wanted to discuss in person. Schellenberg had to hurry back to Berlin. Heydrich's praise was meaningful. He was a cold man and didn't hand out accolades if he didn't mean them. Plus, he held keys to Schellenberg's advancement within the Nazi hierarchy. But Schellenberg was starting to enjoy this undercover work immensely all on its own. It was as thrilling as he'd hoped. But it was time to expand the game. With Heydrich's blessing, Schellenberg needed someone to play the role of his associate. He recruited his good friend and former roommate, Professor Max Decrinus, codenamed Colonel Martini. On October 30th, 1939, the pair and an SS agent departed for their meeting at the Dutch border. But when they reached the border, something unexpected happened. The British agents never showed at the designated meeting spot. The three men began to get nervous. Where were the British agents? two Dutch policemen approached them, demanding to know what they were doing. Then, despite their cover story, the policemen ordered them to drive to the station. Schillenberg was nervous. This felt like a trap. But he saw little choice. He got in the car and did as instructed, reassuring Max with a soft nod. At the station, the police officers began rifling through the three German men's belongings. Schillenberg was getting increasingly nervous. This had to be a setup. But he knew he had prepared perfectly. Nothing was out of the ordinary in their suitcases. Except for one roll of aspirin tablets wrapped in an official German army label in the agent's bag. Schillenberg realized the error as the policeman rummaged. He felt faint for a moment, but then pulled himself together. His first real test in the field, and he was ready to meet the challenge. In a quick, deft movement, Schillenberg pushed his own bag over to the policeman and grabbed the roll of aspirins out of the agent's bag at the same time, sticking it in the only place he could think of, his mouth. The Dutch officers didn't notice the sleight of hand, nor his pained swallow. Instead, they switched from their search to questioning, but Schillenberg, delighted with his quick thinking, had regained his confidence and announced that they certainly would not talk unless they had a lawyer present. Before lawyers could be much further discussed, Lieutenant Copens arrived and ordered the Dutch officers to release the three men. Copens led the pair outside the police station. Waiting there, Best and Stevens. The British officers tried to explain away the arrest as a terrible mistake, but Schillenberg was too shrewd to believe that. The British agents had done their due diligence, and despite the fact that they liked him at the last meeting, they'd had him searched to make sure they weren't getting double-crossed. Unfortunately for them, Walter Schillenberg was too good to be caught. He benevolently brushed aside their apologies, content that he'd fooled them yet again. And so the talks resumed. They lasted about 3.5 hours. By the end of it, Schillenberg had a massive headache. He had smoked too many British cigars. But his acting had worked yet again. The Brits were so taken in by Schimmel and Martini, aka Schillenberg and Max, that Best invited the two Germans to his own house for dinner. Fischer, aka Agent F479, was also invited, and despite all the lies and secrets around the dining table, the meal went off delightfully. Schillenberg even had a moment alone with Fischer, finally getting to talk to him in person for the first time. He promised Fischer he would be protected and helped if he ever returned to Germany. Like his superiors, Schillenberg believed in rewarding good work, and Fischer, just like Schillenberg, had gotten himself welcomed into the British fold. Despite his headache, Schillenberg was thrilled. The plan was working. This was in large part thanks to one particular tactic Schillenberg was using to woo the Brits, an apparently personal, ardent hatred of Hitler. According to the CIA's Strategic Psychological Warfare Manual, people come to love or detest a person much more readily than they do an idea. Schillenberg understood that centering his cover on ardent hatred of a person, Hitler, helped make his apparent betrayal of Germany seem psychologically realistic to the Brits. Plus, anti-Hitler sentiment was so strong outside of Germany that it served as an excellent tool for building common ground. So excellent, it got Schillenberg and Max an invitation for the next day, October 31st. They were brought to a Dutch firm, really a cover firm for MI6. There, they were given an English radio set with a special code to contact the British Secret Service at The Hague, Then they were sent on their way with friendly handshakes. They drove straight to Berlin. Schillenberg was ready to take the talks to the next level. If he kept meeting with Best and Stevens and gaining their trust, he'd have a better chance of getting valuable intelligence out of them. But over the next few days, he received no directive from his superiors. Finally, after a week of waiting, he decided to take matters into his own hands. He wasn't going to let all his hard work go down the drain. On November 7, 1939, Schillenberg met with Best and Stevens and reassured them the plan was still in place. In fact, Schillenberg wanted to take the operation to London, going as far as arranging for a plane to take him and the fictitious anti-Hitler general to England. Schillenberg knew that if he could place himself in London, in the center of the enemy's stronghold, he could collect invaluable information. Still, there was no word from his superiors on what path to take moving forward. But he forged on anyway. He made plans to meet the British agents yet again on the 9th, even recruiting a German industrialist to play the general. Then, on the night of November 8th, everything changed. As Schillenberg lay in bed, drifting off to sleep, the telephone rang. Sluggishly, Schillenberg groped for the phone in the dark. On the other line was Heinrich Himmler himself, and he had grave news. There had been an assassination attempt on the Führer's life. When we come back, Schillenberg's mission changes in the face of Hitler's fury. Now, back to the story. Late on the night of November 8, 1939, in the midst of making plans to go to London and continue infiltrating British intelligence, Walter Schillenberg received a call from his mentor, Heinrich Himmler. An assassination attempt had been made on Adolf Hitler's life. While it failed to take down the Führer, several old, well-respected party comrades were killed, and Hitler was furious. Himmler explained to Schillenberg that there was no doubt that the British Secret Service was behind the attack. This meant that Schillenberg, for the first time in over a week, was receiving orders pertaining to his mission, and this time, they were from the Führer himself. He was to meet his British contacts the following day at the Dutch border, as planned, and then he was to throw away his ruse and arrest them, bringing them immediately back to Germany. Schillenberg listened quietly to the instructions. He was acutely aware of the consequences. All his undercover work would be thrown away, and the door he had carved out into British intelligence lost. It would also mean a violation of the neutral Dutch frontier, but none of that mattered. The Führer wanted these Brits, and he wanted them now. There was nothing to debate. Schillenberg agreed to the radically new instructions. Tomorrow, they would act. As soon as he hung up the phone, Schillenberg pulled himself out of bed and got to work. He called up an SS leader to help him with the mission. They would have to act immediately when the British agents drove up to the meeting the next day. Now, only a few hours away, their best bet for pulling off the operation was by using the element of surprise. The morning of November 9th, 1939 dawned. As far as British intelligence officers Best and Stevens knew, everything was still going according to plan. After Best got over his initial suspicions of Agent Fisher, he was truly convinced by the charming and straightforward Schimmel, aka Schillenberg. They thought they had nothing to suspect. They drove down to meet Schimmel at Café Bacchus, a sleepy café in the small Dutch border town of Venlo. a mere 16 feet away from the German border. In fact, the border barrier was visible from the cafe. Schulenburg was ready, or so he told himself, as his car approached the Dutch border. Even the most skilled of spies gets nervous, but Schulenburg, as ever, turned his attention away from his anxiety and towards the task at hand. He made sure the SS agents present were fully briefed and prepared for the operation. As the afternoon approached, Schulenburg traveled over the barrier to the cafe. He ordered an aperitif and drank a strong coffee. The cafe was unusually crowded. There seemed to be a lot more people here today, a lot of them strange-looking and suspicious. Schulenburg assumed the British agents were taking precautions, but that shouldn't matter. His men were prepared to act instantaneously. These agents wouldn't have time to react. But as 3 o'clock, the appointed meeting time, came and went, Schulenburg began to worry. Why hadn't the British agents arrived yet? Had they somehow caught wind of his plan? Each car that drove by perked Schulenburg's interest, but it wasn't them. At 3:20, the British agent's car finally appeared. Schulenburg stood up to greet them. Their big Buick approached the cafe before turning off to the side to park. Schulenburg walked toward the car. Best, who was driving, remembers seeing Schulenburg wave. The German was still maintaining the illusion that he had no idea what was about to happen. And then, the hidden SS car burst from behind the German customs house on the opposite side of the border. Gunshots rang out. Shouting erupted all around as Dutch police officers ran around aimlessly trying to figure out what was going on. The SS car came skidding around the corner, just behind the parked Buick. Lieutenant Copens jumped out of the car and aimed his revolver right at Schulenburg, who was still standing in front of the cafe. The bullet sped towards him with extraordinary speed. But Schulenburg dived out of the way, and Copens turned toward the Germans. The volleys continued until Copens fell to the ground, dropping his gun. The SS leader yelled at Schulenburg to leave. The confusion raged on, but Schulenburg was no soldier. He didn't have to be asked twice. As he fled, panting, towards the German border, he turned back for one last glance, heart pounding, and saw Best and Stevens getting hauled out of the Buick. The Germans had been successful, and the events became known as the Venlo Incident. Schulenburg was relieved. The plan had worked. The Führer himself would surely be pleased. But Schulenburg felt a tinge of regret anyway. His undercover game was up. The SS agents, meanwhile, smuggled Best, Stevens, and fatally injured Copens across the border into Germany. It was only back on their home turf that they made a startling discovery. Copens wasn't the British agent he'd seemed throughout his talks with Schulenburg. He was a Dutch intelligence officer, real name Dirk Klop. Dirk Klop died of his gunshot wounds while in German custody. But even after his death, his involvement in a British plot to overthrow Hitler, despite Dutch neutrality, would have dire consequences. Hitler used it to justify his invasion of the Netherlands. Schulenburg, as an intelligent policy man, wasn't surprised by this outcome. But he was surprised when Hitler used propaganda around the trial of the British agents to further his justifications of war. The facts around the case were clear. The man responsible for the assassination attempt, George Elser, openly confessed to committing the crime. but whatever the facts, propaganda can be a powerful counterintelligence tool. In the book, Persuading the People, British Propaganda in World War II, historian David Welch describes propaganda as appealing to the instinct of the masses rather than to their reason. Now, this means that it's a useful tool for manipulating public opinion, whatever the facts around an issue may be. And manipulation, as we've discussed, is perhaps the most important tool in all of intelligence work. Schellenberg knew and understood this, so the fact that he struggled with Hitler's insistence on this sham trial was surprising. Well, maybe Schellenberg had grown fond of Best and Stevens and disliked seeing them manipulated, at least by someone other than him. Perhaps Schellenberg was just upset that any hope of continuing his undercover ruse and traveling to London was shattered. As far as the Nazi leaders were concerned, however, Schellenberg had been successful in his mission. Though it wasn't the exact plan he had in mind, he was part of a plot that successfully fooled both the British and Dutch intelligence agencies for months and contributed to the biggest British embarrassment of the war so far. Even Hitler himself was pleased with Schellenberg's performance. The Führer awarded Schellenberg and his SS team the Iron Cross, a special military decoration for their role in the Venlo incident. Schellenberg wasn't immune to the glamour of the Iron Cross or Hitler's praise, but he was also starting to have some doubts about this mounting war. During his talks with the British agents, Schellenberg had learned a lot about British sensibilities, and he knew that England would never negotiate peace with Germany. As he put it, "This war will be a life and death struggle between brothers." He was also starting to realize that Hitler was coming slightly unhinged. As he put it, Hitler had highly developed political instincts which were combined with a complete lack of moral scruples. But his one dominant and dominating characteristic was that he felt himself appointed by Providence to do great things for the German people. This messiah complex was frightening to Schellenberg, and the disconnect between Hitler and reality only seemed to be growing. The Führer only heard what he wanted to hear. Schellenberg knew that didn't bode well for running a successful war, a complex matter that fared best when many minds came together to create airtight plans. He started to wonder if perhaps, in case things turned bad for his allies, it would be best to have a backup plan. But for now, Schellenberg was beloved by both Himmler, the head of the SS, and the SD, Heydrich. Thanks to the Venlo incident, he was now the golden boy of the Nazis' foreign intelligence unit. That meant more responsibilities, more missions, and most importantly, more self-autonomy. The spy who craved power was about to go unchecked. Thank you for listening to Espionage. And we'll be back Friday with part two. There, we'll cover Schellenberg's continued rise to power in the world of Nazi counterintelligence, and we'll follow some of his incredible intelligence operations, including a plot to kidnap the Duke and Duchess of Windsor. You can find more episodes of Espionage and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify. Well, not only does Spotify already have all of your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals, like Espionage, for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker. To stream Espionage on Spotify, just open the app, tap Browse, and type Espionage in the search bar. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll be back next week with another deep dive into the world of clandestine operation. Espionage was created by Max Cutler and is a Parcast Studios original. Executive producers include Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Trent Williamson, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carly Madden, Travis Clark, and Joel Stein. This episode of Espionage was written by Ben Fleck, with writing assistance by Maggie Admire. I'm Carter Roy.